Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another Bite Marks special episode. And joining me today for a very special episode is Chad Johnson. Say hello, Chad.
Hey, everybody. I hope everyone's doing well and ready to get into some meaty topics. I'm excited.
Yes. We actually have something very special for everyone because today we're going to be talking about a movie that is really good that you should go and watch if you haven't already seen it. There's going to be spoilers. But if you have seen it, you've probably had a lot of thoughts about it. It's probably been something that maybe you've not wanted to watch with your parents, or maybe you have watched it with your parents, and that is Parasite, the 2019 tragedy comedy directed by Bong Joon-ho. I'm sure I've butchered that pronunciation. Korean listeners, I apologize in advance. And Chad, why don't you tell the viewers about yourself and maybe a little bit about why you're uniquely suited to be on this episode.
Cool, so thanks, Emilio. I am Chad Johnston. I'm a teacher. I teach out here in South Africa, but previously I taught English for a year in South Korea. And specifically, if anybody thinks about South Korea, they immediately go, oh, Seoul. I taught outside of Seoul. So I think I have a unique perspective to add to this type of, particularly this film, and particularly this topic.
So for some clarity, you taught in a rural area in South Korea, right?
Yes, I taught in Yechonggun, which is in Gyeongsangbuk-do, which is the largest province in South Korea. And if I'm not mistaken, I could be wrong here, but I think it's also the least populous. There's a lot of sort of farmland and informal, I don't want to say informal because they are formal areas, but they are, they're not cities.
Yeah.
Where I taught. So and, I taught around, yeah.
Yeah, we'll get into that a bit later. For those of you who don't know, Parasite is a film about social commentary. The director, Bong Joon-ho, directed another piece of social commentary, which I think is also very interesting, called Snowpiercer, with Captain America fighting in a train in a world that is maybe ours when we fail to do anything about climate change, because of course we do. and Snowpiercer is a direct struggle of a lower class of people trying to overcome their circumstances, trying to get out of the system. Parasite, on the other hand, is a lot more of a subtle movie. And its subtlety, I think, is maybe one of its biggest pitfalls, and we'll get into that a little bit later. But the general synopsis of the film is that it follows the Kim family, who are a really, really poor family. Now, obviously, everyone's standard of poverty will differ from country to country, but, you know, for reference, these are people who, they can't afford higher education, they live in a very cramped, very terrible kind of basement, right? They eat kind of terrible quality food, and they don't really have a lot of amenities. There are four people in the family. There's the father, Kai Tech, his wife, Chung Sok-suk, their daughter, Ki Jong, and the son, Ki Woon. And the plot of this movie kicks off when Ki Won's friend, Min, who is university educated, who is a little bit more of an upper class person, is going to study in America. And he says, Ki Won, my friend, I need you to take over my cushy tutor job for this wealthy family. There are the Parks. They have a lot of money. I trust you. So on and so forth. Do the job. And his friend is, and Ki Won is initially hesitant to do it because he has no qualifications. He's a smart person, right? I feel this has to be stated. He is more than sufficient to actually do this kind of job. It's just that he can't afford to get, you know, the qualifications to do so. So he fakes his credentials and becomes the tutor of this incredibly wealthy family. And I just have to say, the contrast between the Parks and the Kims is like night and day. The house that the Park family lives in is an architectural wonder. I'm sure anyone who's ever seen it, you're just awed by its splendor. And the movie basically follows the entire Kim family as each of them ingratiates themselves and incorporates themselves into the Park family. The father, Kai Tech, becomes the driver, the mother becomes the housekeeper, the daughter becomes a au pair slash, I think it's art therapist for the youngest Park boy who has some issues, and we'll talk maybe about them a little bit. And very quickly, Parasite follows the descent into madness, where initially everything seems fine and it looks like it'll work, but then rising tensions in the family, in both families, in the environment, and also the pressure of the lie boils to the surface, and eventually it ends in fairly lethal consequences. So what did you think, just off the top of your head, what did you think of the movie? Did you like it?
I absolutely loved it. I must confess, my Korean is not as sharp as it should be for someone who lived there. And when it came out in South Korea, it ran for, I mean, so just if I may, just a little bit of context on South Korea and their film scene and so on and so forth. They are heavily into big commercial successes. So if you mention a Marvel movie there, they'll go crazy. And the Marvel movies generally run for quite a long period of time. I think Endgame, I think, ran for about 8 weeks. I could be wrong. And I'm pretty sure Spider-Man also, because Tom Holland came to South Korea, it ran for a little bit extra as well. Mm. It could have run for about 5 or 6 weeks. Parasite, as far as I remember, Parasite must have been in the cinemas in Korea for close to about 9 weeks. It ran incredibly fast, because there was such a lot of hype around this movie. And my confession is that I didn't go and watch it in Korea, which I think would have been the proper authentic experience. But I actually came back and I watched it at the Bioscope in Joburg.
Here's a question. What do they serve in Korean movie theaters? Do they serve popcorn? Do they serve, like, what do they serve?
Do you know what? I think that a better question would be, what don't they serve in Korean movie, in Korean cinemas? I mean, I don't want to be that guy and say that everything is relational to capitalism and communism and so on and so forth. But it really is almost a gorging event when you go to the cinema in Korea. There's exorbitant amounts and flavors of popcorn that you can choose from. You can have pizza. You can have whatever you need.
I think they inherited that from the U.S. I think that's definitely the U.S. culture filtering into South Korea. And it's something we will eventually talk to. But let's circle back a little bit. Yeah. So Parasite is, by the admission of the creator, a very anti-capitalist movie. But it's an anti-capitalist movie that is very subtle. And the reason for this is because it doesn't really want to take a moral side in the conflict between the Parks and the Kims, right? We get to see the Parks and the Kims basically in their natural environment. Now, what do I mean by that? I mean, the movie, a lot of anti-capitalist media and a lot of the way that people think about sort of capitalism is, oh, the workers are the morally good people and the capitalists are the mustache-twirling villains. Yeah, I know, right? It's completely not true in this case, because both families are depicted with positive and negative attributes. I'll speak a little bit about the Kims, but then if you pick up with the Parks. But the Kims are poor people. They are desperately poor. They don't have the money to improve their situation in society. And they can't really do anything else but kind of scheme. And so even though they are desperately poor, they don't really have much of an option in order to sort of get by and try to, you know, they're unemployed. It's very hard to get work in Korea for a number of different reasons. They aren't necessarily malicious. They don't plan on, like, murdering the Park family and wearing their skin, but yeah, I know, right? That
could have changed the context of the movie completely.
Oh, you know, that's a very literal interpretation of the title Parasite. But yeah, they don't want to do that. They just want to get better jobs, to get more money, to buy better things. How do you experience the Park family?
It's a difficult question because the Park family are your sort of Korean elite, I guess. They are. So the Park family is kind of what Korean people aspire to be. If you know anything about Korean business, there are a few families that really control the economy. So you've got the family that owns Samsung, the family that owns another big company that I can't remember off the top of my head. And essentially, everyone wants to be the Parks. And what's very interesting for me is when I hadn't seen the film, and I went out to a bar in Seoul, and I had a couple of Korean friends, and they said, you know, have you seen Parasite? And obviously, you know, I put up my fingers and I said, no spoilers, don't you dare. And the first thing that my friend said to me was like, you know, I want to be like that rich family. And obviously I hadn't seen it and so on and so forth. So I just kind of like let it fly. But when I did go and see that, when I did go and sit and watch the film, it's amazing how particularly, and I mean, this is a whole other topic, about masculinity and Korean masculinity and how the boys and the men aspire to be what essentially Mr. Park is or isn't. Because from a film perspective, I also studied film, so I can give you a little bit of a film perspective as well.
Oh, no, this is great. This is great.
So from a film perspective, you know, Mr. Park could be this wonderful man and he could not be this wonderful man. It depends on what the director is trying to say. But yeah, it was just very interesting for me how they positioned this family as the family to be.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, the Kim family, their entire struggle is a struggle to be like the Park family. And it's only in coming into immediate and very personal contact with the Park family that they realize that the Park family have their own, you know, various dysfunctions, shall I say. You know, again, we're going to be spoiling things, but like, let's take, for example, Mr. Park. He is a very powerful man. He is a high-ranking CEO of a tech company. And for him, you know, all of his concerns, I found it interesting that he's very detached from his family, you know. He tries to be, quote-unquote, the dad, to have a masculine role, you know, to be there for his son. You know, in the classic way, he takes a very keen interest in developing his son, but he almost entirely neglects his daughter.
Yes.
Which is, you know, That's kind of like the way that a lot of men are kind of raised to be. Oh, you know, your son is going to be your inheritor. He's going to be da da da. And it's a very ridiculous kind of thing. But, you know, South Korea has a problem with patriarchy, which, you know, I will pick your brain on a little bit later. But he's still very dysfunctional because he treats his family like objects, right? His wife is a trophy wife. She can't do anything. That's why they have to have all of these domestic helpers, all of these servants, really, because they can't maintain the house without people to do the work for them. She can't cook. They can't clean. It's almost this entirely artificial life where the people in it are totally divorced from, you know, their reality of living. And here's the hot take. It doesn't necessarily make the Parks bad people, right? I feel the important thing to come away from Parasite is that the Park family are not overtly malicious. They don't necessarily, you know, they don't really treat their employees like slaves, right? You know, we presume they treat them relatively fairly well and they talk to them and et cetera, et cetera. But what they don't do is they don't show any malice towards the people that work for them. Rather, they just treat them as part of the system. They treat them as, you know, instrumental. And that is entirely because the Parks are extremely wealthy. If they weren't that wealthy, they would be able to, I would argue, relate more to the people that they work, have working for them. But they don't.
Can I just jump in there?
Yes.
While you're on this point?
Yeah.
What you said was so well put because you spoke initially at the beginning about the subtlety. And that's exactly how it is. That's the subtlety of capitalism. You are not necessarily, you're not turning around and going, you're poor, get away from me, I don't want to speak to you, I don't want to interact with you. But it's the subtlety of, you know, they don't necessarily treat them bad, but you as an objective viewer, you sit there and you go, I mean, surely they can realize these people are living in squalor. Like, again, it's a spoiler, but I don't know if you, I don't know when last you've seen the film, but there's that particular scene where they're driving and Mr. Park gets the smell.
Mm, yeah. I don't
know if you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, yeah, I do.
The smell of poverty. And I mean, something like that for, I mean, I guess, I want to call us all normal because not all of us live in that, or the majority of us don't live in that type of world. But for normal people, just socially, I mean, that's not an appropriate thing to bring up.
No, it isn't.
And it just speaks to the subtlety of how he positioned, particularly, and I'll always refer back to the director because it's his choice.
Hmm.
You know, how he positioned how they relate to capitalism. And, you know, again, it doesn't make them bad people at all. Sorry, I just wanted to stress
that's actually a great segue, because one of my favorite scenes, and I have a fairly good memory, so I, even though I've seen Parasite maybe a year ago, I still have very vivid recollections of some of the more, you know, interesting scenes. But one of my absolute favorite scenes in the movie is the rain scene, where you get to see the two different families and how they experience the same thing, i.e. the rain. So if there's any part of the movie that just demonstrates that it is not the individual moral failings or virtues of every person, but rather the system, it's the rain scene. So what happens in the rain scene, for those of you who maybe don't remember? Well, it's raining. South Korea is a rainy place. I'm sure, Chad, you can attest to, it rains a lot in South Korea.
It doesn't.
It doesn't?
It does.
Sorry, I misheard you. It rains a lot. And for a lot of people, we don't really think about the effect of rain. Certainly, you know, I have a roof over my head, you have a roof over your head. It's not that much of an issue. But for the Park family, it's just a pleasant evening, right? They get to gather around, the rain is pouring, it's a nice, peaceful, serene moment. The family, you know, they gather together, they're nice and cozy in their, you know, Mac mansion. And for the Kim family, it's utter ruination. It is utter disaster, because where they live is downhill from, you know, all the nice properties and so on and so forth. So what has happened is all of the water that is raining down is just accumulating and flooding the entire district. So, you know, the Kim family are going home to their house, and what they don't realize is the district is flooded. Everyone is panicking. People are being trying to get their whatever meager possessions they can salvage out of the rain, out of the water. They have it worse because their house is underground. It is a basement, essentially. And so it's utterly flooded. It's just a mess. It's a nightmare. The toilet explodes, for lack of a better word. And they're just surrounded in this utter misery. And they have to go live in it. They have to go spend the night in a gym, I think it is, or something like that.
Yes.
Because they don't have anywhere else to go. And the thing is, the day after that, they still have to go back to work. They still have to go and pretend that they didn't just watch their entire house be flooded, all their possessions ruined. They had to spend the night in a gym, huddled up, you know, with hundreds of other people who were also dispossessed. And the thing is, both families experienced the same thing. They both experienced the rain. But the difference was, one family was way better situated to experience that rain, and the other family was in a position to be, you know, harmed by it. And that is, you know, the system of capitalism. It doesn't really matter morally about, you know, who you are, you know, because it really doesn't. You know, in that moment where the rain is falling, there aren't necessarily good and bad people. There's just people running with a bucket with, you know, maybe all of the things that they could salvage, and someone who is sitting in front of a fire watching, you know, the rain just gently fall down on their really nice manicured lawn.
Exactly that. I think you've hit the nail on the head as well. And when I will get more into the experiences or what it's like in Korea as well, but particularly that notion of there's that it's the same sort of scene, but there's that beautiful, beautiful image. And this guy, just from a film perspective, he has this unique ability that I don't think a lot of filmmakers have. He can tell you a story in one image. And there's that lovely image of names. Don't you dare tell me. I think it's Ki Jung and Ki Woo. They are running down the stairs.
Ah, yeah.
And it's almost this, or what I took from it was this lovely allegory of they are now, because at that point in the film, they've worked their way to, I guess, what would be the top for them. And it's this beautiful image of them running down the stairs back down to reality.
Descending back into the...
Descending back, you know, and how, you know, capitalism is a lovely system for you if you're born into it. And, you know, if you can maintain that lifestyle and so on and so forth. And if you play devil's advocate here and you go, well, they kind of sort of fake their way into capitalism, which I don't think you can, because they work bloody hard working class people to get to where they are. But it's that wonderful image of them just running down the stairs to go and save their possessions.
Yeah.
And how they sort of, I mean, there's beautiful images of the descent into madness of them running down the stairs.
Yeah.
The descent back into reality. It's just, that is also, by the way, my favorite scene. It's one.
From a, you know, it's just such a visceral scene because, you know, one moment you're just with this family. Maybe you have memories, you know, of with your own family, just sitting around, just watching the rain, you know, maybe drinking some cocoa or some tea. And then the next moment it's panic, desperation, fleeing, running, don't know what's going on, you know, it's just brilliant. And, you know, I have to say here, the cinematography of this movie is really, really good. One of the things that I noticed is that stairs are actually a very common, or just not just stairs in general, but sort of height in general is a very common visual motif. In the house, in the Parks house. Now, it's a very massive house. I would encourage you listeners to go and look at a video of it. It's brilliant, gorgeous architecture, 10 out of 10. But the house has a secret, right? In a way, this is a nice visual metaphor because, you know, just like how the house on the top is really, really nice, once you get a little bit lower, then you start to see actually, it turns out that the house is built on an air raid shelter. Because, of course, you know, for geopolitical reasons, North Korea and South Korea have a tense relationship. We won't get into that one now. But suffice to say, there was a real fear that, the North Koreans could attack. Every rich person's house should have a shelter, because I assume the poor people are just going to be firebombed or whatever. And in the basement, or in the secret shelter, is a person who has been trapped. The husband of the before Chung Suk becomes the caretaker, the previous caretaker's husband has been just living in the basement, and she's been feeding him secretly, and because he had to run away from debts, I think it was. But there you go. You know, it's a nice double layered visual metaphor, because on the one hand, those stairs are really important to the narrative. They are a moment of fear. It's descending into confronting, you know, the reality of the situation that, you know, I have to talk to this person who might give me up, you know, who has potential power over me. I have to deal with them. I have to keep my position. I have to push down on that person so that I can stay up. And also, you know, the descent into madness, because over time, there are several points in the movie, they do descend into madness. Like, for example, the moment where the two families are busted, where one group finds out about the other, and the jig is up, and they get into a fight, and they end up basically killing that guy by pushing him down the stairs, and then I think they incapacitate the woman and tying them up together, and it's this weird, most insane thing, because at that moment, I think there's like a party going on, and everyone is just, you know, doing their own thing, and it's a nice fun party. It's a cat, you know, it's a child's birthday party, and then in the basement there's just horrific violence, and it's because, you know, visual motifs, height, like you said, with the stairs. I want to zoom back a little bit here. You mentioned, the scene with the driving. So the Park family are in many ways the total nuclear family, right? You've got the husband who he brings home the bacon, or I guess the Korean barbecue in this case.
the samgyeopsal.
I've been learning a little bit of Korean stuff. I made for the first time ever kimchi pancakes, and they were
delicious.
They were really nice. I love kimchi. Viewers at home, there is some very interesting food in this movie. There's a scene where Mrs. Kim, she makes a udon dish, and it's like the most amazing thing you'll see in the movie. It's just like this gorgeous noodle broth with these really expensive, meat. It's like prime rib or something like that. It's really expensive.
Yes.
And it's just casually, the Park family just like casually eats it. But for them, that is like the god tier food, because the Kim family is only ever eating like low quality garbage. And, absolutely, it's a sign of wealth for them that they can afford to eat like a pizza. I want to pick your brain on this, because it's not often that I get to talk to someone with some intimate experience. Like, what is the pizza culture of South Korea like?
I am, after this, I'm going to share your podcast with my Korean friends, because they did ask to listen to it, and I do not want to insult them, but you know what, bloody hell, I don't live there anymore, it's horrible. I have never been around a culture of people that are so willing to put anything on a particular style of food, or so on and so forth. I have had... just to give you some insights, there was a stage where I was cutting down on my meat. Mm-hmm. And also, interestingly, before I answer this, what you were saying about the Parks being able to afford that type of dish, the prime rib, beef is hellishly expensive in Korea. Hellishly. Beef is sort of like a luxury dish. It's something that you order on, or... if you're in a particular class, you order it on special occasions. And the fact that the Parks can just go into that type of, the fact that they're, eating that type of diet also speaks a lot about where they sit in the class ladder and so on and so forth.
A quick tangent. It's also mentioned that fruit is very expensive in South Korea, and the Park family just always has fruit. But please continue.
Fruit is a lovely little visual motif there as well, where you look at it and you go, wow, I mean, when I was living in Korea, it's a sad thing to admit, but I didn't eat much fruit because it was expensive.
Yeah, fruit is expensive.
It is. And so anyway, back to the pizza thing. Yeah. I have had a pumpkin and sweet corn pizza.
Oh, no.
which is an abomination on its own. I have everything from... broccoli to eggs on top of the pizza. So look, Korea's done a lot for the world, and they are, I always joke with my family and I say they're my home country, because I love Korea so much, but pizza is one thing that I think needs to be taken away from.
Yeah. I have some Korean friends. Pretoria has a relatively decent Korean community. If you just sort of look at, you'd never expect it, but there are actually quite a few Korean people, and I've had some very close Korean friends. And pizza is just, sorry guys, it's not the play. You guys, there's something I don't know what's. I have a theory, but I'll get to that a little bit later. The movie ends in a. Again, we're going to spoil this, but the movie ends in basically the only way it could have, I think. And I want your thoughts about this. But as these schemes of the Kim family begin to unravel, as they're forced to, beat up these people and put them in the basement, conspire to get, because to get these jobs, they have to fire the people that are already working there. So the Kim family conspires to get other people fired. And it is probably their most morally unambiguously bad thing that they do. They don't have the qualifications to, but anyway, I don't want to get dragged up on that. But at the end of the movie, the Park family are hosting a birthday party for the youngest son. And again, it's weird. It's Native American themed. We have to talk about that. As the party is going on and da 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 da, the guy who they've been keeping in the basement breaks free. Oh, sorry, I got it wrong earlier. They killed the wife of that guy. They didn't kill him.
Yes.
I missed that one. And then he breaks free. He gets out of the basement. He's frenzied. He starts attacking people. In the confusion, the girl, I think her name is Ki Zhong, she is stabbed and she dies. She bleeds out. And then the Mr. Kim is so like traumatized. He just like when Mr. Park is trying to tell him to give him the keys to the car so that he can, you know, take his family away from this place, he just snaps and he just murders Mr. Park. It becomes kind of a scandal, this big, massive, epic scandal. You know, of course it would. No one knows what happens to Mr. Kim, although it's revealed that he takes the place of that guy who was in the basement. He lives in the basement trying to eke out a meager existence as a new family moves into the house, and kind of the same cycle repeats. The son, Ki-woo, he quote unquote has a, you know, he says he'll work hard and he'll, you know, become successful so he can buy that house and free his father. But I think the last shot of the film is just him daydreaming about that, because that's a fantasy. That's a fantasy that he's telling himself, really. The movie ends like, how do you feel about the ending of the movie?
I just want to go back a little bit about just for continuity things. So the reason that Mr. Kim murders Mr. Park is he's actually really disgusted by Mr. Park, because Mr. Park's son is, just give me a second, a whole second, Dasong. His name is Dasong. And Dasong, you remember earlier in the film, Dasong is speaking, he speaks about seeing someone in the house, a ghost. And it's actually the previous house lady's
husband
that he sees. And then when the guy, I know his name, I'll think of it now. When he comes out and he's frenzied, his wife's just been murdered or whatever, he starts attacking people. Dasong has a seizure. He has a reaction to his name is Gunse. Gunse comes out and Dasong has a reaction, and Mr. Park he's only concerned about getting Dasong to the hospital, even after Ki Jong is stabbed and she's busy bleeding out. And Mr. Park turns around to Mr. Kim and he says, give me the keys, I need to get my son to the hospital. And he's got no, because obviously, I mean, if you put it in a literal sense, she's in more trouble than the child. She's bleeding out, she's dying, whatever. And even in that moment, you would expect somebody's humanity to
Let's take them together, grab her, let's go, you know.
Exactly, let's take them together. He's considering only his son. And I think that's why Mr. Park is murdered. I think the ending is superb. I think that's exactly how it needs to end. And the thing is, you would kind of feel like, and this is where I think it's so brilliant, is that you would kind of feel like, okay, well, Mr. Kim, in the end, he got his sort of vengeance, you know, his revenge. He got to kill Mr. Park. But at the end of the day, what good does it do? You know, he loses his daughter, he's stuck in that house, and his son is probably never going to attain the wealth to buy that that house over. So I think it's just a wonderful comment on the cycle of poverty. How you're born into it, and I mean, we'll discuss this a little bit later as well about Korean society, but you're born into a particular family, and that is where you stay, regardless of, you know, what you try to do, what you think you're doing, it just doesn't work like that. So I loved the ending. I thought it was outstanding.
Yeah, I liked it too, because I feel like there's no way that a movie that is, you know, because throughout the film, you are kind of rooting for and booing the Kim family. You know, you have moments where you see them be clever and game the system, and you're like, yes, you guys are doing it. But then you also have moments, you know, where they see them fire someone, where they see them, you know, hurt other people, like, no, you guys are bad. But at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter, because even the act of killing Mr. Park doesn't really do anything. It just perpetuates the cycle, like you said. And then it just, life kind of just goes on, you know, in this terrible way. The system remains the same. The poor, they stay poor. The rich, they stay wealthy. And that is a perfect segue into talking about sort of capitalism in South Korea, because I didn't just want to do this because I want to talk about Parasite, even though I could talk about it, you know, for hours. I think there is a misconception that people have about how capitalism is kind of manifested in South Korea, because I think from everything that I've been talking, you know, to you and to Miles about, because you guys have direct experience, South Korea is late capitalism personified. South Korea is way ahead of other nations. In fact, probably Asia is way ahead of other nations, America, Europe, and so on and so forth, in terms of what the consequences of late capitalism are, right? And I would like you to, you know, to speak about your experiences in South Korea, and maybe we can, you know, tie this into a broader point.
Sure. That's a great question. When you think about, so if you go back to, you know, World War II and what was going on at the time, the USSR and America were obviously two big, the Soviet Union and America, they were the two big players.
Yeah.
And what had happened is, which, I mean, if you think about it retrospectively, which it's always fine and well to do, I guess, but retrospectively, that horrible system of they would get to certain places, peninsulas and so on and so forth, and they would divide it up amongst themselves. So essentially, the USSR took North Korea, which became communist, and America took South Korea, which became capitalist. And look, I haven't been to Japan, but I think from my experiences of travel and so on and so forth, or speaking to other people and whatever, I think Japan is the only other country that I think sort of embraces American capitalism as hard as Korea does. It's quite incredible. You know, I don't even know how to get into it. It's so stark and it's so shocking.
Well, you know, let's relate this back to the film. So there are many ways in which I think Japan and Korea in particular have become posters for American-style capitalism, right? You know, back in the day, the divide between North Korea and South Korea was deeply ideological. But what America did, and it did it with Japan as well, is it pumped a huge amount of money into these places, and it got to dictate economic policy. It got to dictate cultural policy. Here's a great example of that from the movie. Ki Jong calls herself Jessica, right? To the family. She adopts a Western name. The family is really interested in American. Like, one of the weirdest things about Parasite is that the little boy, I keep forgetting his name.
Da-song.
Da-song is obsessed with cowboys and Indians, but he has no idea about the actual cultural impact that the genocide of the Native Americans actually, you know, what those symbols mean, you know? And it is this exporting of American capitalism, right? The commodification of culture itself that has come to define, you know, South Korea. This hyper fixation on, you know, traditional masculine values. That's really an American thing. That is a Protestant American thing that got exported. You know, because again, how many people in South Korea are Christian? South Korea is extremely Christian, you know. They had problems with COVID because megachurches were, you know, super spreading. And where else does that happen? In America. It's this, you know, I did a little bit of research. I was reading an article. I think it was written by the New York Times. And the article was about a U.S.-Korean person who, it was about a bunch of different people, sort of, and a U.S.-Korean person who moved to South Korea, and she didn't know how to speak Korean, right?
Yeah.
She moved there to be an English teacher, but
yes,
she faced discrimination for not speaking Korean, but then she also faced discrimination for not being white enough to be an English teacher, right?
Yes.
And something that came through the article was that there is this fixation on emulating Western culture, but only from Western people. And, you know, that only, you know, we need English teachers. And, that, you know, that's why this is a trope. But like a lot of young, you know, white kids who don't really have, you know, much of a solid plan, well, they can go teach English in Korea or in Japan or China, you know, for a while. And it's like, okay, that's really weird.
Yeah, look, what you're saying is you're hitting it on the head. It's so, like you said, the US pumped in a lot of money into America, and over the years, you know, Korea has for the most part always kind of been, and well, I won't say for the most part, in general, they have been an American ally.
Yeah.
And because of, I mean, I had a co-teacher in Korea, and he always used to drive me to work in the morning, used to drive together. And we always, whenever we were speaking about politics or, you know, the state of the world and whatever, he always used to say to me, you know, Korea is the most, he used to joke about it, but it was very telling. He used to say, Korea is the most unlucky country in the world because of their strategic position for North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
America loves it because of their position in the war. You know, Japan was there, they colonized Korea. You know, if you go back to the dynasties and so on and so forth, because of Korea's position and in terms of trade, China colonized. So we always used to speak about this, and it really is that, you know, that they're an unlucky country in many senses. You know, they've benefited from their position and so on and so forth. You know, America's popped in a lot of money into Korea. But with that has come a lot of obsession with American culture. Mm. So, I mean, Miles, you can also attest to this fact, you know, the first question you'll get asked in Korea, besides your weight, your height, and your age, that's a given. You will always get asked, are you American? If you do not look Korean, they will ask you, are you American? They actually have a word, I can't think of it now, but they have a word for Koreans that don't speak Korean that come to Korea, and they face a hell of a lot of sort of social pressure to learn the language and so on and so forth, particularly if they stay for a long time. They face a lot of isolation, but it's just it's this very weird relationship with America where I think over the past 4 years, not to mention any names, but hashtag Trump has also strained that a little bit. But they've got this weird obsession with American culture, so everything is very Americanized. For example, I lived in a rural sort of area. The main The capital of my province was, I guess, the main city. And we always used to go there. And one of the more English bars was called Indies. and Indies was absolutely styled after Native American people. There was no illusion. There was nothing trying to. And I mean, if you think about the optics, Indies, Native Americans, you know, already in the name is it's a bit much. But also, I mean, they had bloody tiki torches and Native American headdress all over the place, and you walked in there and you were like, yeah, but what is happening, you know? And you shouldn't find a place like that.
To be fair, you can cast shade on South Africa for having Spur.
You know what, I was just gonna say, Indies was almost a bar version of Spur. If you can imagine Spur as a bar, that's what Indies was.
Please no.
So, look, they have an obsession with American culture. And that, again, it filters back to the movie, the taking of the Western name.
Yeah.
The need for, you know, in Western society, they are very... they're very attached to this idea that you need qualification, you need a degree. Korea is all of that whole idea of you need to have a degree to actually know anything in this world,
or
to have social status. All of that is heightened in Korea. It's heightened to 100%.
We read stories about like the terrible conditions that kids, like, they have to study excessively, they have to, you know, give up all their time to do extracurriculars, et cetera, et cetera. You know, I was a great example of like cultural exportation is, I was going to say pizza in South Korea, because Koreans don't have a history of eating cheese. Most Asian people don't have a culture of eating cheese. Cheese eating is something that is distinctly European for a number of different, historical factors, you know, climate, animals that were available, et cetera, et cetera. And consequently, many Asian people, including, you know, Asian people who are like Indian and, you know, even Middle Eastern, are lactose intolerant. So the idea of pizza, this tomato-based bread thing with cheese, lots of cheese, is just weird, right? And it's not something that evolved from local Korean customs.
Not at all.
It's something that was directly transplanted into Korea. And now it has become a symbol of, you know, status. Oh, you eat pizza. You don't eat whatever it is that, you know, you might be able to be eating. But, you know, it's interesting that you talked about Korea's history. Like, so here's the thing. So here's the tea, people. Korea has a very complicated history with colonialism and imperialism. At various points in history, Korea is the punching bag of other nations.
That's a wonderful description.
It is the punching bag of China. It is the punching bag of Japan. You know, I remember reading that throughout Japan's more violent history, which, you know, that is a whole nother topic. Oftentimes they're like, okay, well, we're gonna distract everyone, you know, with domestic issues. We're just gonna go invade Korea and do a bunch of looting, and it's gonna be fine. And, you know, I think that does something to the psyche of a people. And, you know, this is where I put on my armchair psychology, but I feel like this cycle of being trapped by people who are oppressing you, you know, one of the national heroes of Korea is Admiral Yi Seung-sung. I think that's how you pronounce his name. Brilliant military strategist, but what is this guy? He is this guy that managed to save Korea in its darkest hour. It's kind of like a foundational myth. And what would that do to a people like this? Well, chances are it would probably make them very xenophobic. It would probably make them very hesitant to think about outsiders, to think about people who are foreign. And, you know, I want to read more, read a little bit more from that article. So the other part that was being talked about in that article was a Korean woman who was traveling with an Indian friend, not her boyfriend, not her husband, just a friend from work, right?
Yeah.
And they would get stares. Everyone would treat them as if they were like, you know, aliens. they weren't being affectionate. They weren't like holding hands. They weren't a couple. They were just friends in the way that, you know, men and women should allow to be friends. And they just, and people were looking, and, you know, her coworkers, when they saw her, like, are you dating this guy? What's going on? And it's like, no, he's just a friend. And it's, you know, again, another example of this kind of thing. It's like, yeah, if you are a Korean person who doesn't speak Korean, you're going to have a hard time. But if you're not a white person, if you're a non-white, non-Asian person in Korea, you're going to have even more of a difficult time, right?
Yeah.
Because Indian people, Black people, Arab people, Polynesians, all people that aren't white or Asian do live in Korea, right? You know, a lot of people talk about Korea's homogeneity, and the truth is it's not really homogeneous. Here's where I put my Marxist hat on. So Korea's growth, right, has been very exponential. South Korea was at one point in time one of the fastest growing countries in the world in terms of, like, you know, GDP and, you know, all of that stuff. And when it was doing that, you know, it was buoyed by, you know, a population that was transitioning from being, you know, rural to urban. You know, you said the rural population, rural province, is one of the least populated. Well, that's because all those people left and went to the cities. But then what happened? As capitalism started to go, as standards of living started to rise, as capitalism started to churn, right, in the way that capitalism does, it got a little bit harder and harder and harder to start raising families. People started having fewer and fewer children. With education comes crazy ideas like sex ed and teaching people to use contraceptives and da-da-da-da-da. And suddenly now you're in a situation where Korea has a population that isn't growing and that can't sustain its growth, right?
Well, it's declining.
Yeah, it's declining, just like Japan. Japan is arguably even worse. Japan is, you know, facing a real fundamental crisis of its extreme xenophobia to allow other people to live there, and its terrible capitalist, you know, workplace practices and so on and so forth, making it an unsustainable society. But in Korea specifically, right, what would capitalism's solution be to this problem? Well, the answer would be take in migrants. take in migrants. And what have we been seeing in Korea? Well, gradually, there are migrants, you know. I've been reading some articles where it's like, yeah, you know, a lot of people who do a lot of the manual labor in Korea are migrants. And they're not migrants in always the traditional sense that we think of. They're not like, you know, Mexican people might be to...
A lot of them are Russians.
Some of them are just other Koreans. You know, some of them are just ethnic Koreans who live in places like China, for example.
From that perspective, yeah, I know exactly. There's also a word for that.
It's weird because, you know, these Korean people are suffering from capitalism, right? When you hear interviews of people, of Korean people saying, no, we don't want these foreigners here. They're going to, they're going to take our jobs. Dude, your boss is giving away your job. You know, don't blame an immigrant who's coming here, you know, to do menial labor, right, that most Koreans probably don't want to do anymore. Your boss is the one who's giving away that job. Your boss is the one who's like, I can probably pay that guy less than I pay you, so I'm going to pay him less, and then I'm going to trick you and tell you to be afraid. I'm going to stoke the xenophobia, you know?
Yeah.
Because it's one thing for people to have a history of colonialism, imperialism, like the Koreans do, but it's another for them to take the lessons, the wrong lessons of that colonialism and imperialism, and just be like, okay, well, we have to make ourselves the bastion island. We have to, you know, do these nonsense policies, because actually it turns out that you need people. You have to either give up on capitalism, which you don't want to do, so that you can make a society that doesn't require endless growth, or you have to accept immigrants into your country. And, you know, it's funny that there are so many different Korean words for different kinds of foreigners. Well, guys, those people will eventually become Korean too, you know? It's this weird antagonism, and it's entirely because of capitalism, right? You see the same thing in America. You see this antagonism between high-ranking billionaires and, you know, businessmen being like, we're going to protect American jobs, you know, we're going to build a wall. And then those same American businessmen hire, under the table, migrant laborers, right?
Exactly.
It's, I don't know. You see, I feel like a lot of Koreans need to grapple with this, because, like, Korea is a country, like all countries that are experiencing capitalism, you know, they have to grapple with this idea that they can either be capitalist and, you know, give up on some of their xenophobic ideas because it's not sustainable. They will end up like Japan. And Japan, you know, I played a game once. I always tell the story. I played a game once called Techno Babylon. Right? So Techno Babylon is a sci-fi game. Really interesting. In the game, the US no longer exists. It's just warlord states. It's just warlords that just rule different parts of the country, like the warlord of Miami, the warlord of Florida.
Oh, I love that.
I love it. Yeah, it's funny. Texas is actually one of the biggest ones. No figure. But in this world, it's mentioned several times that there are many migrant populations of people because A, climate change, B, war, you know, C, economic opportunities. The game takes place in a city in Africa that is extremely diverse because Africa was at the forefront of one of the capitalist cycles. Capitalism comes to Africa and it becomes the new place, and lots of people migrate into Africa, and the Africans are like, well, yeah, we'll just let these people in and they will do the jobs that we don't want to do, and you know, the city is like a shining cyberpunk city. But Japan is mentioned in a couple of news articles. Japan has such a population crisis that the government has to clone 40% of all Japanese people just so that they can get people to continue to do labor. That's how bad it is. And they don't want to accept any people from anywhere. They maintain this extreme xenophobia. And it's like, okay, so now 40% of every four in every 10 Japanese people is just a clone from one person. It's like, guys, come on. Come on. Really? it's maddening.
I think it's a crazy thing because, you know, you're speaking about the xenophobia and all of that. And I would say it's certain career, and that's like, I think capitalism messes you up so much as an individual that you kind of think to yourself, I should be xenophobic, but I've also got all these foreign friends. You know, like, that's really what capitalism has done to Koreans, and particularly Korean men. And it's really messed them up. I mean, I have some of the most incredible friends I have in my life are Koreans that live in Seoul and all of that. And that's the thing. And I mean, it can be a whole other podcast about Seoul. And I think relating it back to the movie, and that's why it was so beautifully done, is that it's also, that whole movie takes place in Seoul.
Yeah.
And for most parts, you know, I'm sure there'll be a lot of, if I share this with my friends and whatever, there'll be a lot of people who only have been to Seoul and whatever, and they'll say that I'm lying. But Seoul is a different, I almost want to say, country to the rest of Korea. And, you know, most people that haven't been outside of Seoul, they don't realize, you know, an interesting thing for me, an interesting realization is that when I was watching Parasite, I was like, you know, this is very similar to a lot of the kids that I was teaching where I lived. You know, that was their day-to-day life. And there weren't many of them that were mega rich or anything like that. You know, so it's a very interesting thing that capitalism does to us, where it says to us, you know, we have to protect our jobs, we have to look after our own, we have to be, in a sense, xenophobic, and also, but there's foreigners, but they can help us, but they can
there are these people that we're supposed to hate, but also, you know, let's eat their food, let's, you know, upload YouTube videos in their language, let's engage in their culture, but not want to
let's bring them in to teach us their language as well, which a lot of people don't realize. English in South Korea is a compulsory subject. You have to take English. There's no if, buts, or maybe about it. The Korean English teachers are phenomenal. I have met English teachers here that do not know the grammar and the rules of grammar the way that the Korean English teachers do. But they do. They bring in a hell of a lot of foreigners to come and, you know, sort of coach them through. And that's essentially what I did in Korea. I was a language teacher. You know, I was teaching you how to speak instead of grammar and all of that and so on and so forth. So, I mean, that also within itself is really almost ironic and paradoxical, you know. We don't want foreigners here. We don't want you know, people to come in and steal jobs and so on and so forth. But at the same time, we want to learn your language so that we can go overseas.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
And interact with other people.
Yeah, so we can be a part of the global community, but the global community can't be a part of us, you know, in
exactly.
a way.
Exactly.
And that's exactly, I hate to say this, but that's kind of exactly the logic of capitalism. It's the buy low, sell high mentality at its heart. It's do as little as possible required to change the economic system in your own country, to change the social system in your own country, but do as much as you can to influence the cultures and economics of other people. Because, like, if you can get your products, you know, because the lesson of America is if you can get every other culture to adopt your culture, that's how you win the global market, right? You export movies to other people, you know, you export your language, you export your food, your fashion,
yeah,
everything. Those people have to change. They change themselves, and they become your, you know, your biggest consumers. And, you know, South Korea, you know, wants to do that. Japan used to do that. The dominance of things like anime are a great example of Japanese capitalism mobilizing its cultural forces to change, you know. Everyone.
I was just going to say, you know, Japanese anime is much bigger than what people will give it credit for.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think I've encountered a person that hasn't watched an anime once in their life. Even if they don't like it, they've seen it,
yeah,
you know. And, you know, if we look at Korea in a contemporary sense, that's what they're doing with K-dramas.
Yeah.
That's what they're doing with K-pop. They're sort of going into, and just sorry, I'm a massive K-pop fan. So just on that, it's also very interesting to see how many K-pop stars, mega, mega stars, are also not Korean. So, you know, one of the biggest groups at the moment is Blackpink. I would say that they're the biggest girl group at the moment. And, you know, there's four members. One of them grew up in South Korea. The other two, or two of them, lived in other countries and they're Korean. And another one is Thai.
Oh.
So, you know, again, this whole idea of, we don't want people here, but, you know, our idols, some of them. There's another one from another boy group called GOT7, Jackson Wang. He is a, he's Chinese, you know, and Korea has a very complicated relationship with China. They're not Chinese people's biggest fan.
Yeah.
Fans. You know, everything about the country itself speaks to that. And because, you know, I spoke about how many Americans, or how America popped in so much money to Korea and all of that, I think it's the perfect sort of micro example of America.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. We want to, you know, to tie it back, because we are almost out of time, but yeah, to tie it back to, you know, the movie, the Park family needs the Kim family to do their labor for them, but they don't want to be changed by the Kim family. They don't want to experience them as human beings, to see that, okay, well, if we let these people, you know, really in, if we understand their personal lives, if we know about their struggles, then they will change us. We don't want to do that. We only want their labor. We only want their utility to us. And that's, yeah, it doesn't make the Park family evil people. It just means that they are victims of the same system that the Kim family are, but, you know, from the opposite end.
Exactly. And they really are victims.
Yeah, yeah, they are. The Park family is very dysfunctional, and I don't think they would be as dysfunctional if they had maybe a more grounded upbringing.
Yeah.
Maybe they'd be dysfunctional in different ways, but I've always been of the opinion that extremely wealthy people are so, they live in a different reality. They're so sheltered from what it means to be a person, what it means to struggle, that it's like a glass house. But I definitely want to continue this conversation.
Yeah.
I think we still have a lot more to talk about in terms of, you know, South Korea. I would love to, you know, continue talking about it, because I think it's very interesting. I think it's very important for people to realize that capitalism is a drain, and the entire world is circling that drain. But I feel like South Korea is closer to the end than many other places are. And we have to know, like, the entire point of this movie, the entire point of Parasite is we have to wake up. We have to realize that the system that we have in place is hurting us, and we can do better. You know, the director doesn't really say what that better will be, but, you know, that's kind of not the point. The point is we have to first wake up, and then we can, you know, hit the alarm button.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for coming, Chad. I had a lot of fun.
I did too. This was really cool.
I would love to have you on for another episode.
Absolutely.
And do you have anything that you would like to shout out to the listeners? Social media, you know, a project that you're working on? Your Twitter? No.
I am hilariously boring on Twitter. Yeah, the only shout out I'll have is to my kids, please do your homework. But for everybody else, yeah, I think this is just such a great platform. It's such great conversations that you're having. And yeah, I'm hoping that we can really get this to really blow up.
Because, thank you.
I think it's an awesome, awesome thing that you're doing, dude.
Yeah, I wanna build this platform that I can get lots of different voices on here to talk about stuff from all parts of the world. You know, from Africa, from Asia, from America, from Latin America. I want to talk to all kinds of people and share their stories. That's what this whole thing is about. And also, I want to talk about video games, but that's where I'll leave everyone. Please check out Bitemarks. We're on YouTube. We're on Spotify. Probably wherever you get your podcasts. We have a Patreon. If you're feeling generous, you can give us $1 or $2 a month. That really helps. And good night, everyone. Have a good day. Take care. Be safe. Bye.
Bye, guys.